It's Here and Now from WFPL News. I'm Todd Mundt. For many of us, the internet is interwoven into every aspect of our lives. And for many of us, internet is synonymous with Google. We perform all our searches on Google. We use Gmail. We share photos on Picasa, events on Google Calendar, our documents on Docs. We use Android phones, even Android tablets. Google has grown to immense size with immense profits through its ability to make money on how we search for information. The more it's learned about us in aggregate, the better the quality of the results it's delivered to us. And going forward, the more it learns about us individually, what we like, what our friends like, and where we are right now, the better it will be able to deliver the answer we need even before we finish typing the question. Google tells us that this is a rare case of a near-perfect alignment between a company that wants to do good and a company that makes money. Others are not so sanguine as they consider the privacy and other implications of Google's hold on us. Well, Stephen Levy is with me. He's the senior writer at Wired Magazine. And before that, he was at Newsweek. He is the author of 7 books, books about Apple. There's a book about the iPod. His book, Hackers, Heroes of the Computer Revolution, was voted the best sci-tech nonfiction book of the last 20 years by readers of PC Magazine. His new book is In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives. And he is appearing at the Louisville Free Public Library tonight at 7 to talk about it. He's here now with us. And Stephen, thank you.
Thanks, Todd.
Let's start with the recent news that the longtime CEO, almost from the very beginning of this company, Eric Schmidt, was stepping aside, although not leaving the company, to be replaced by one of the two gentlemen who founded the company. There was Sergey Brin and Larry Page. Larry is going to be the new CEO. There's been a lot of discussion about what that means. I'm going to start first with the Eric Schmidt part. Is Eric Schmidt being booted out, or what's the story there?
I think Larry, who was the CEO before Eric was there, and he actually felt that he should continue to be the CEO, it was the venture capitalist who forced Larry and Sergey to get what's called adult supervision. But it was always clear that Larry was going to, at some point, assume control of the company that he co-founded. And some people were surprised that it happened at this exact juncture. But if you roll it back, it seems logical. Google really needs, I think, an infusion of energy at this point. They're facing challenges that are unique in their history. And they wanted to sort of double down on Larry Page's vision. Because as I did this book, and it was really the last minute I was able to get this in the book, that they announced this switch, I looked back and I realized Larry's vision was actually always Google's vision. Sergey shared the vision, but Larry was always the driving force.
And describe to me exactly how he was the driving force behind that vision. I mean, this is a guy with big ideas.
Right, right. And so there's a few things about Larry which have become Google's characteristics. One is he's obsessed with speed. Things have to be done fast. And people have told me great stories about how when they're in his office, he could detect down to the millisecond how long an operation takes. He's obsessed with scale, of making things big, big, big. And that's Google's name, which is a pun on a term for one followed by 100 zeros, is indicative of that. But most of all, he's fixated with ambition. And when I had a long interview with him for the book, that was one thing he really wanted to get across to me. From a young boy, really, he believed in taking on big, ambitious tasks. But he feels now, of all times, we have the ability, because of this amazing technology which has come to fruition during the past few years, to make what was once thought impossible actually within our grasp. And he's disappointed that more people don't take advantage of that and take on big tasks. And he's particularly disappointed when people in Google don't do that, don't say, well, let's take on the biggest task there. So the story I heard over and over again about Larry is someone will come with him with a proposal, and we'll say, we'll need 100 people to do this. And he would say, oh, why not 10,000? So if you offer him a toothpick, he'll ask for a forest.
This is the guy who said, why can't we digitize all the books in the world? And in some ways, he was disappointed by the response that he got from that, from the publishing industry and from others.
Yeah, very much so. And that's a great example of the way he thinks there, that a lot of us were brought up to think, wow, what a thing that would be to get every book ever printed, to be able to jump within the covers of the most obscure book imaginable if you had a question that only could be answered in that book. So I went to graduate school years ago, and I spent all this time in a dusty library trying to find the right thing there. Just imagine sitting there at your desk and finding exactly the right thing. And Larry, in particular, saw that this is actually within our grasp. It wouldn't cost that much money to do it for a big company. And he set about doing it and was very disappointed when the world did not embrace what he felt was an obvious boon to civilization.
And update us where that is, because there have been some court rulings on it, and it's been batted back and forth. I mean, where is Google now as far as books?
Right. Well, the first roadblock they had was a lawsuit that was filed by the Authors Guild and the American Association of Publishers, and that was settled. Google settled that suit and came across with something that was actually a bigger scheme, where Google would not only have these books scanned, but would wind up selling books that were out of print, where authors couldn't necessarily be found, and they would hold the money until the copyright owners claimed it. Well, a lot of people felt that was way overstepping what a private settlement should do, and a parade of people went before the court to say this settlement shouldn't go through. And I was in the courtroom to see this, and was amazed that these people and the groups, many of them who would have been natural allies of Google, really love the spread of information, really love open systems like Google does, were testifying against Google and identifying it as a, sort of a monstrous big entity, and you know, in horrible terms there. Even the science fiction writers of America were testifying against Google. I thought it was a particularly low blow because so many of the engineers who work there love science fiction. And of course, the government also was speaking against Google, saying there was antitrust implications in the settlement, and the judge, just about a month ago, struck down the settlement there. So they're back a little to square one on this. It's not clear whether Google is going to continue working with the parties that sued it, or whether it will return to the previous state and argue that it had a right to scan these books because it was a fair use. They weren't giving the whole contents, but just the a little snippet of the text there, like they do in the search engine there. So I think they're looking at their options.
Stephen Levy is my guest. He's written the book called In the Plex, which is about the rise of Google, and it certainly looks forward to where Google is going. You said there were a mix of challenges that the company is facing, and this seems to be the right time for Larry Page to step back in as CEO. What are those challenges?
Well, there's a very big challenge, you know, in the short term, and that is what Google is going to do about this wave of social information. You know, information that has to do with people. And through its history, Google has not been all that successful in this area there. You know, they've been successful in a number of areas. They've done a remarkable job actually in positioning themselves in mobile technology, which was really important for the future because more people very soon will be searching on our mobile phones than on things with keyboards. But right now, Facebook has shown that there is a huge movement towards this social information there. And for Google, this is imagine their motto is to get all the world's information and to make it accessible and to organize it. And here is this valuable corpus of information. People willingly share great information with Facebook, who they are in contact with, what their interests are, what they're doing, and Google can't get at that. Facebook doesn't share with them. So Google feels that it has to generate its information on its own and somehow get Facebook to the table so it could use that information for better searches and other things.
There, Google's attempts at this have been somewhat odd. I don't remember all of them, but Buzz, there was some difficulty around that, around privacy issues. We may get a chance to talk about that in a bit. There's currently the Plus One, where you can click on a search result and say, I recommend this, and you may see your friends. Apple has also had problems trying to get into the social space. What is it that Facebook knows, or you know, what is in the DNA of that company that isn't with Google in particular?
Well, one clue might be the founder of Facebook is a whole generation younger than the folks at Google, and probably at least two generations younger than Steve Jobs. But I think that actually it is more that this is what Facebook started out as, and it was just woven into the basic mission of Facebook there. And Google was, you know, started on a different plane entirely, and really didn't feel that that information should be its highest priority to pursue that. And now they think differently. And you know, you mentioned the Buzz, and that was the previous big social project they had, which was just hobbled out of the gate by this terrible flaw in privacy that Google didn't perceive because it tested it internally and didn't realize that it's a different situation in testing a social product when you just test it within a cloistered, homogenous group as opposed to leaving it out in the wild to see how it works there. And as it turned out, there was a privacy flaw that they missed. Now, the Plus One is something different. I think that's part of what Google's current plans are, and they're just revealing it bit by bit. There's a very big initiative they're working on now, and I identified it in the book. It's called Emerald Sea. Hmm. And that's their current privacy initiative. And it's so important that Larry Page, in one of his first moves as CEO, said, guess what, guys? Next year's bonus to all Google employees, not just the people working on the Emerald Sea project, is going to be contingent to a certain degree, I think 25%, on how well Google does in social. So it's very, very important to the company.
What do you know about this next iteration beyond the Plus One to what Emerald Sea is going to be? I mean, the company doesn't usually reveal a lot, but what have you been able to find out?
Well, I won't say specifically. I can say that I did agree as part of my ground rules for researching this, because they let me see a lot of stuff that was in development. And I promised them that I wouldn't pre-announce any products that weren't out at the time the book came out. But I was able to talk a bit about the origins of this Emerald Sea project. And one fascinating thing about it is that the first thing that comes up in Google image search when you type in Emerald Sea is this painting by a 19th century artist named Alfred Bierstadt. And it's a painting of a giant wave, a tsunami-sized wave, and there's a little sailboat that's right in the nook of the wave. It looks like it's going to get engulfed any second there. And the head of this social project at Google explained it to me, saying, well, this world of social, that's a wave that we're either going to ride very high on and, you know, successfully come to shore, or it's going to engulf us. So that's how important Google thinks this is.
Based on what you've seen, and I won't ask you to go into any more detail, that do you feel like they have a fair chance of riding that wave?
Google has a lot of assets to bear in competing in the social world. They know a lot about us, the people who use the project. They have terrific engineers. And I think they have an element of engineering that Facebook doesn't really have in terms of people who are equipped to judge relevance and rank what's important as they do so successfully in the search engine there. So I think that they certainly have the assets to build a very useful social product.
I'm going to come back because I don't think I've done justice to how important you think Larry Page is. I have this quote from your article in Wired. You said, the general public may not appreciate the magnitude of the change. To most, Larry Page is just one of the seemingly interchangeable pair of Google guys. But Page is sui generis and could potentially have the kind of impact Bill Gates and Steve Jobs have had. That's really an incredible statement about this guy and the impact he could have on all of technology and beyond.
Well, that's right. And I said that having familiarity with those other two gentlemen. Larry is, you know, in his own quiet way, he's not a very extroverted person, but in his quiet way, he has a charisma about him. This says something about him here. So recently he did a reorganization of the company and elevated some people to his key lieutenants, people in charge of various divisions of Google, like the Android division or the search or ads. And some of these people, there's only a handful of people who now hold this position of senior vice president. And some of these people have been with the company since its very earliest days, literally in the first 10 or 20 employees there. And these people, because they got in so early and they were important people at Google, they are as rich as you can imagine. They don't have to do anything for the rest of their lives if they don't want to. And Larry asked each one of them to say, listen, in order to help me revitalize Google, I want you to commit that you're going to stay here for a few more years. So this would have been a time for those people to say, well, I'm on to the next stage of my life. They're all pretty young. And they instead, you know, all but one of the people he asked to make this commitment said, well, I'm in. And that's a sign of how much they believe in Larry. They think that interesting things are going to happen. He has, as I said before, those big ambitions. He's fixated on artificial intelligence in particular. And I think if you want to look at what Google's going to do in the far future, you look to artificial intelligence combined with its mastery of huge amounts of data, and you think of things that haven't been done before that Google might try to do.
So he does have the two pieces, really, of greatly. I'm sure there are more, but he sees a vision. He gets it. He understands a strategic position for the company. And I just added a third. He has charisma. Even though he's a kind of a prickly guy, he's not exactly highly sociable, but there is something about him that attracts people to him.
That's right. And it's interesting. In some aspects, he really shies away from publicity. And you know, he's not a glad hander. But on the other hand, if you witness him at these meetings that Google does every Friday afternoon, it's an all hands, anyone can show up meeting where employees can literally ask any question they want, even hostile ones, of Google's founders or its top executives. He and Sergey quite often run those meetings together. And they're a jolly pair. It's almost like Hope and Crosby. They banter with each other, and they're very much within their comfort zone with other Googlers, as employees are called there. And they can be pretty funny.
Stephen Levy is my guest. We're going to take a short break here. He's the author of In the Plex. It's a book about Google, and we'll continue to talk about Google in just a moment here on Here and Now from WFPL News.
Support for WFPL comes from Metro Parks Golf Courses. Open from daylight to dark 7 days a week. 9 courses with fully stocked pro shops, as well as men's, women's, and juniors associations. Memberships and annual passes are available. Rates and details at metro-parks.org. From the Kentucky Derby Museum, presenting a new exhibit about the jockey who has been called Billy, Willie, and the Shoe. Bill Shoemaker, 4-time winner of the Kentucky Derby. The exhibit features his private collection of Derby memorabilia at the Kentucky Derby Museum. Open daily. Tickets and information at derbymuseum.org.
Stephen Levy on Here and Now from WFPL News. I'm Todd Munt. Stephen, the author of most recently In the Plex, a book about Google. And there have been a number of books about Google, but there's something about this one that I think compared to, well, I read John Battelle's book, Search. I've not read all of them, but I've read a couple. And I felt like this one gets beyond that initial founding story, which is a lot of fun, to actually the deep, kind of the inner workings of the company. And that's because you got in. And
right. Yeah, John,
how did you get in?
John interviewed me at an event last week.
Yeah.
And he told me, wow, this is all the stuff they wouldn't tell me.
Well, how did it come that they would tell you?
Well, I've been following Google since as early as its days, really, when I was working at Newsweek. And like you mentioned, there were some other books about it. But when I went on this trip in 2007 with a lot of young Google managers, really their future leaders there, I had the opportunity to spend 24/7 with these people. And I realized there was a dimension of the company that just had not been discussed. It's really to learn about how it thinks. You have to spend a lot of time with the people. You realize how totally in sync with the internet this company is. And I thought, wow, it would be pretty interesting to write a whole book to try to get that kind of access and really see Google as an outsider from, you know, with exposure from the inside there. And I pitched it to Google, and to my delight and a little surprise, they said, okay.
Have you ever figured out why they, I mean, this is a company that doesn't reveal a whole lot.
I think that at this point, and you know, I started my project in 2008, they were understanding that they have to be a little more transparent than they had been. A lot of people are going to be scrutinizing them. Trust is key for how people will use Google. And they maybe were sensitive to the idea that Google has all these black boxes that people can't see into, and letting someone who they perceived to be a sympathetic ear to view their operations might be something that ultimately would be to their benefit is my guess.
This is the company with that unofficial motto, don't be evil.
Right.
To what extent do you get the sense that people really... Well, I'll just say what I read in your book, I came away with a much stronger sense for how people inside the company feel about don't be evil. I thought it was one of those things that a lot of people don't talk about on a day-to-day basis. But the way you describe it, it is, in fact, in the front of mind of people in that company every day.
That's right. I was surprised because by this time, every time some criticism comes up of Google of something they're doing, whether they're keeping information on Android or something else comes up in privacy, and people say, what happened to Don't Be Evil? It's really used a bludgeon against them. And I thought at this point they might regret it. But surprisingly, they said, no, this has been a useful metric for us, really. And they, even though they won't stay in a meeting, is this evil, is this not evil? It is something that people do think about there. Though I will say that it's tougher to stay on that side of this binary divide of what's evil, what's not evil, when you're a big company and things get a little more complicated. So some of the things that Google's doing now, my guess is, might have been in the evil category had it been presented to the founders in the very early days. But now they see there's maybe two sides to it, and things are a little fuzzier.
This is a company that does seem to be willing to change its mind about issues. It has dealt with the Chinese government, whereas at other times it has stepped away. It's censored its Chinese website. Other times it's chosen to shut it down, or for a while it fought the Chinese government over moving it to Hong Kong. Is this a company that's really very carefully watching what people say about it?
I think that it's not really a company that likes to go what popular opinion drives it to. They like to go to what they think is the answer to a question. They're very data-based. They're very logic-based. So they'll move forward based on those things and sometimes be disappointed when what they feel is the compelling logic behind what they do doesn't win over the public necessarily.
Are they going to make more of an effort to try to defend themselves publicly? I mean, maybe this book is a part of that, but...
Well, I thought they were moving in that direction now, but the movement of Larry into the CEO role, as opposed to Eric Schmidt, who is more of a social person, he's more of an explainer, might indicate they're not going to do that much. I didn't think that Larry would go on a big press tour when he got to be CEO. I know he doesn't like talking to the press particularly, but I'm surprised to the degree to which, even in this period where it could be his honeymoon period, he has avoided talking to the press. When they made the announcement that he would be CEO in January, and really he stepped into the role at that point, and even though it formally didn't take place until this month, but he did a few 5-minute phone calls with a couple of press places. For some of the reporters, like the one in the New York Times, it was the first time they ever spoke to Larry, which shows how cloistered he really is, and how he doesn't like to talk to the press much. And I felt that there might be a few places which got more extended exposure to him. But despite what I think is probably recommendations from the communications people at Google that he do that, he has not done that. And he actually disappointed the Wall Street analysts recently by checking in to the first earnings call since he became CEO. He appeared and just said, yeah, I'm really excited, and then left when the questions came. And some people are saying, where's the communication here? Isn't that part of the CEO's job?
I'd hate to leave just about a minute or so left for one of the big revelations of the book, which was that early in their search for a CEO, they asked Steve Jobs if he would consider becoming CEO, and he turned them down. In light of everything that's happened since, there's been a portrayal of Steve Jobs as, a ruthless competitor. He's upset with Google over Android and other issues, and now it's in a fight to the death. Is that a popular press kind of view? Is there still some kind of relationships that there? Have we just anthropomorphized it?
I think there is still a relationship. There's a lot of products they work on together. Google Maps and YouTube you'll find on the iOS operating system there. But I think what's fascinating to me is by all the evidence I've been able to gather, it looked like Steve Jobs actually was personally offended. He felt a little betrayed when Google went and did a competitor to his iPhone there. But it's business, and these are all business people, so who knows what might happen there. Their frenemies are almost the norm in Silicon Valley.
Stephen Levy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I hear that your event tonight is nearly full. I think there's going to be some standing room.
Yeah,
back
well,
there for people.
That's great. What a great town for authors.
All right, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Stephen Levy of Wired Magazine, recently of Newsweek before he left to go to Wired, and he is author of a number of books, including In the Plex. That is his latest book. It is on it's essentially the history of Google, but of course, as you can tell from this conversation, he's spending a lot of time looking forward. In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives. He'll be at the Louisville Free Public Library tonight, 7 o'clock in the main library. And again, a lot of those seats are taken, but we're told there's always a chance that you can get in on standing room only, or maybe someone is not going to show up tonight and you can get in and wrangle yourself into a seat for what should be a good conversation tonight. Tomorrow on Here and Now, among other stories, we're going to be looking at the population in West Louisville. It's dropped significantly, and we'll consider some of the issues behind that decrease in the African-American population. Here and Now from 89.3 WFPL News.
Support for WFPL.